the importance of having diverse professionals in your field. In the case of students, as I said before, it's helpful for the students to see someone or interact with someone who shares a similar identity as them. It's encouraging, it helps them to see that it is possible for someone to be in that role, and that usually those who work in those positions, we have studied abroad ourselves. And so seeing somebody that has achieved it is encouraging to know that it is possible.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of World Strides Podcast, Changing Lives Through Education Abroad, a weekly series of conversations with international education's most interesting thought leaders, as well as discussions on emerging trends, best practices, and innovation happening in our field. I'm your host, Zach McGinnis, and I'm very much looking forward to this week's episode. Today, our conversation will center on advancing diversity, equity, and inclusion within the field of international education. This topic is critically important, and I'm thrilled for the opportunity to lift up the voice of the one and only Aguna Ogwu-Jones. Aguna currently serves as the faculty-led program coordinator at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and has worked in international education for close to 10 years. I like to think of Aguna as something of a Maryland queen. Aguna will help us unpack best practices around hiring and supporting staff with an inclusive lens, championing access to opportunity, and shared tips to safeguard against burnout. We'll also talk about how she sees our field evolving and have some takeaways for practitioners at any institution to prioritize making the world a more equitable place. All of this and more with a focus on study abroad and how this type of engagement truly does impact our students and our work. I'm so excited for today's discussion. You do not want to miss this episode. Stay tuned for what's sure to be a sparkling conversation. Aguna Ogwu-Jones, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Zach. I really appreciate you having me on. It's a pleasure.
To get us started, I'd love for you to briefly give us an overview of your professional journey and how you came to be in your current role at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County.
So I first studied in the field as a graduate assistant at my alma mater, which is my current employer, University of Maryland, Baltimore County, UMBC. And I worked in the study abroad office at that time. And after I got my degree in intercultural communication with the emphasis in Islamic studies and intercultural training, I then went on to work at several other institutions within the Baltimore metropolitan area in Maryland, including Towson University, where I was there for about 4.5 years as a study abroad advisor. And then I left the field briefly to go work at an HR tech startup company working with recruiters for outbound recruiting as a customer success manager. I was a part of a layoff at that time, and now I'm back in the field and excited to be back in my alma mater with all the wonderful skills that I've honed and all the wonderful presentations I've done and consulted with folks in the field to bring that back to UMBC and help us scale up the number of faculty-led study abroad programs we offered supporting faculty creating policies and procedures.
It must have been such a full circle moment for you to return to UMBC after so many years. So congratulations. Before we go any further in our conversation, though, I want to give you a platform to share some of the good work that's happening at UMBC. What is special about education abroad at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County?
What is special is that we are charging ahead, revamping and reigniting our study abroad opportunities, especially after the lull that many institutions encountered during the pandemic season. And so we are super excited for the increase of students who want to go abroad. We are supporting more individuals. We have more staff members, including myself in my inaugural role, and also supporting more students to get Fulbright opportunities. We recently were awarded at being a top Fulbright producer, which is amazing for the size of our institution compared to some larger institutions in other parts of the U.S. And we're just charging ahead. We have more faculty-led programs we're offering this summer than were last summer since I started. And some of the proposals I received for summer 2025 and the next academic year is nearly double or even triple in some cases. So we are excited to offer more opportunities in a number of different ways for students to get study abroad opportunities while they're here at UMBC, as well as after they graduate for Fulbright and other prestigious awards.
Today, we will have a conversation about advancing diversity, equity, and inclusion in education abroad, which is abroad and in our current climate, an especially complex topic. Let's set the stage a bit with a piece of terminology, and then I have a question to kick us off. You, my friend, have experience working at both minority-serving institutions, such as your current employer, and at predominantly white institutions, PWIs. Could you please define MSIs and PWIs for us?
So MSIs are minority-serving institutions. It's an identification from the Department of Education of the federal government for institutions that have a significant number of students of color who attend their institutions. There's other distinctions under MSI, like historically Black colleges and universities. And so as a general overview, MSI covers that umbrella. And then for PWI, predominantly white institutions, the dominant racial makeup of students are typically white at those institutions. They have not as many students of color or other social identity markers, but what this Department of State goes by are racial demographic markers.
Interrupting injustice and prioritizing equity through higher education and international education is critical work, and we believe it's everyone's job, don't we? What would you share as something you wish fellow practitioners understood about how to be an active participant or champion to advance access to study abroad for all students?
What I would recommend for folks to understand and to learn about the process is, you know, no one group, whether it be a racial group, or of course, there's intersectionality where people have multiple social identities that they identify with beyond just race. It could be sexual orientation and other matters, is not one group is a monolith. There are, of course, nuances in each of those things. However, historically, there are systems in place that have made it difficult for some groups to be able to have access, equitable access to opportunities or have certain conversations around, say, study abroad. They may not have people within their social networks, within their family, their professional networks who've talked to them about this being something that they too can also access that can help propel them academically and professionally. And even in their research, depending on what they like to do while they are in school for undergrad or even in graduate school. And so it's important for faculty and staff that work with students, particularly at a PWI, to be mindful of those things and ask students when you're advising them, what is it that you are, when it comes to study abroad, what potential barriers might you have? And maybe some might not be able to know that offhand, but you don't want to come up with assumptions, but the same thing, you want to give the student the opportunity to let you know what it is they might need, how you can help advocate for them. Also let them know they have agency as well, what resources are available to them to utilize. And in some cases, you might need to help advocate for them internally on an administrative level if they are encountering some barriers, even at your own institutions, for them to have access to those resources about scholarships, getting their academic advisors on board to support them for their interest in international education endeavors. Also internally within your office, it's helpful to kind of do an assessment of what are we doing that might be a hindrance for some students and others? Why is it that some students will enter into our office for advising or engage with our office at a certain point, but they drop off? They don't continue on in the process. Or they submit an application and then they withdraw. Most offices should have this data if they're using database systems or what have you. And you can take the time when, you know, in our busy professional lives, we can find the time, maybe during our walls, maybe in the summertime, to figure out what is it that could be causing that, how could we mitigate that issue and ensure that we better retain the students, that we're supporting them as well as possible. Are there things we could articulate better in our instructions or who we're sending them to for certain processes and make sure they're not getting discouraged from that office and they don't continue on in the process and they don't come back to tell us why they fell out. So those are some of the things top of mind that individuals I think would be keen to look into and to assess and see how they can sort through that, not just on their own, but also working with champions across campus and other offices. We work cross-functionally a lot in our field and seeing what we all can do to help make that easier for students.
Prior to our conversation today, Oguna, you shared some thoughts on hiring practices and staff development. So let's get into it. With your experience working both in education abroad and for an HR tech startup in diversity recruiting as a customer success manager, what best hiring practices have you learned or shared with your domestic and international tech clients that would have some takeaways for our listeners today?
What would be great and what I've told clients I've worked with in the past at the HR tech startup company is, you know, making sure that when you are creating your job descriptions, that it is very clear expectations of time to hire. We post this role. This is what we would like to have the individuals start this company in this role. Secondly, I've seen some really successful clients do well when they state, what is a clear upward mobility track within this role that we're hiring for? Some may say it's just static and that's fine, but at least just having that up and clear in the job description is helpful for candidates, potential candidates who are looking to get into that role and what they would like to do professionally in their professional goals is in a good alignment. Also, it's helpful to note what would be the KPIs or like known performance indicators or metrics that someone who assumes this role would be expected to perform at in order to be considered successful or superseding that for potential raises or for promotion purposes. And then what type of support they would have in terms of their onboarding experience. What would that entail? Those employers that will take the time to articulate these things in the job description. And of course, it may not be a hard and set rule, but at least some guidelines of what they can anticipate so that there's no feeling of, you know, a bait and switch per se, that this is what y'all were talking about in the interview. This is what I saw in the job description. This is what made me apply. And this is what I'm seeing done now that I've actually passed through and offers been made and I'm starting in this role. It's helpful for retention to reduce that attrition rate of people that come in and they don't stay.
I would love to dive a bit deeper here. Who gets hired for a position has such a ripple effect throughout an organization and a long reach, both in terms of time and impact. What advice would you give to hiring managers and HR departments in terms of prioritizing equity in job postings that generate a diverse pool of candidates?
So what I would recommend is being mindful of what places you are and are not posting your jobs, vacant roles. If, you know, as we know in our field, it's a predominantly white number of colleagues are in this field. In fact, all of my supervisors, since I started this field about 10 years ago, have all been individuals who identify as white. And so for others who maybe are, you know, just like our students, when we advise them, it's helpful to see staff for study abroad, at least in that industry. Students are being advised, it's helpful for them to see folks that also look like them or have similar social identities or intersectional social identities, because that can be an encouragement to the students that, oh, this too is attainable for me. I see somebody working in this field. And so similarly, in other industries, even when I was at the HR tech private company, it's helpful about where is it you're posting your roles. Is it just in areas where it tends to be most of the social identity demographic individuals that are typically applying to those roles? But if you really want to be intentional about casting your net wide and really being more inclusive, you need to intentionally also go into those spaces to advertise roles where they tend to be professionals from certain social identity backgrounds. For example, when I was in tech, there are different tech professional organizations for Black professionals. There's ones for Latinx as well, and so forth. And so being intentional to go into those spaces where you can advertise those roles and not just, of course, advertise them, but also, do you have the support from them there? Do you have employee resource groups at your company? Or some universities may call them affinity groups for the sake of international education. But what things are in place when you invite folks to the table and you actually are allowing them to be feel welcomed and included, and the feedback that they give you, the leadership that they show, does that translate into opportunities for them to have their voices heard, continue to make great impact and have some authority in the things that they say, and people take them seriously when they make suggestions on what they see happening on the ground and how we can improve things for everyone involved. So that intentionality, where are you advertising and how are you supporting your workers when they come on board? So some of those things are super helpful in retention and making people interested and want to apply.
Let's bring it back to students for just a moment. How does diversifying the field of international education serve to diversify the students participate in study abroad?
So what I would say for this question is a little bit of what I mentioned earlier, the importance of having diverse professionals in your field. In the case of students, as I said before, it's helpful for the students to see someone or interact with someone who shares a similar identity as them. It's encouraging. It helps them to see that it is possible for someone to be in that role. And that usually those who work in those positions, you know, we have studied abroad ourselves and we've worked abroad. You've done research about some folks have Fulbright as well. And so seeing somebody that has achieved it is encouraging to know that it is possible. And so the importance of diversifying the field ties into that. Also, it's helpful to get some insight, different perspectives, because everyone, even, you know, I identify as a Nigerian American cisgender woman in the field, and my experiences might be different from someone else who identifies as Black or Black American or what have you. And so it's just helpful to have those diversified experiences. And when we create policies and procedures, we do pre-departure orientation. It's important for us to make it clear and cover those topics as it relates to diversity, equity, inclusion, things students may encounter because of how their identity presents itself or people perceive their identities compared to the US and abroad and so forth. So it's really helpful when you have a diversified workforce, including more particularly a diversified professionals in the field of international education who also have actual leadership roles with titles to match. That's also helpful as well. You know, directors and assistant associate directors and the like, or even SIOs, of course, and senior international officers. So all these things, the things that are seen, whether students interact with those people in those roles or not, it all makes a difference. So those would be the top of mind things I'd say for that.
I want to lift up another conversation we had on Changing Lives back in the fall when Dr. Carolina Robinson from the University of Alabama came onto the show and had some really insightful things to say about how diversifying our teams can lead to diversified participants. So thank you, Ogona, for that as well. When we hire someone, we want them to stay. What recommendations would you have for employers who want to tackle international education employee attrition rates?
Like I had mentioned before, and I'll expand on a little further, it's really important to be very clear and articulate in the job postings, the job descriptions or position descriptions, what folks expect to be doing in their roles, how their progress would be measured over time, and also what professional resources are available to them after they've been hired. In the case of international education, you know, there's a number of different, or particularly study abroad, you know, there are site visits, you know, individuals can participate on to better understand how programs are run by providers like World Strides or others in country. So that helps you be a better advisor to the students because you've seen with your own eyes how things are set up. You can better answer questions related to mobility concerns students may have or accommodations. Attending conferences is important. The NAFSA Academy. I myself was very fortunate as a part of the first NAFSA Rise cohort that the little NAFSA organization put on. And that covers a number of expenses for being a NAFSA Academy participant, which is really huge to learn all the ins and outs for your respective subsect of international education, be it study abroad or what have you. And so all that training is helpful. Having a mentor, not every institution may have the staff to do that because some might be a one-person office or so forth, but it's really helpful to make it clear what folks can expect in terms of professional development opportunities. Is there funding behind it? And what's the expectation of how often you can participate in those things, tuition or admission? If people wanted to do additional study. The other thing I want to comment is on kind of an invisible added labor that can occur amongst diverse professionals. Some people can have a lot of passion and want to support students who may have come from diverse backgrounds as well, on top of our regular duties, which can then add additional workload and, you know, time and stress away from other things. So it's really important to be mindful of what you take on top of what you're already hired to do. And it's great work that needs to be done, but it shouldn't only fall on those who have those diverse backgrounds. It should be a shared, important initiative for everyone on the staff to do, whether you identify someone from a diverse background or not. It takes a village to change, to have these substantial changes come about. And so my other caution would be, as it relates to invisible labor, is just, you know, supervisors being mindful of what your direct reports take on who are of a diverse background to ensure that they're still able to take care of what they need. And they're also having a better work-life balance. They're not working too late and things like that. And I know I've had to work on that myself in the past as I was learning and growing. It's like, oh, I want to do everything. And then sometimes I bite off more than I can chew. And that's not good either. So it's trying to just set some clear guidelines and boundaries on what is achievable this season. And maybe this could be something we can work towards in the long term and have some additional support so that it's a better balance of work. But those would be the things that come to mind. And for particularly for the new hires who've never been in the field, it's really important that there's a proper onboarding and again, intentionality behind how they will be trained, because it takes time to learn all the steps involved in that process and study abroad. And if offices may be short on resources, what free things are available there? You know, local stuff through or regional NAFSA group, they might have some free resources that people can participate there. And then maybe even having a mentor, someone that could carve out specific time, walk through any hangups, a new person who's like, I don't understand how this works. What I think this is how it's supposed to go. So having some clear policies and procedures as well is really helpful with that. So it makes it easier to not have to rehash it every single time for some offices that have had some trouble in the past with attrition. Just so at least there's a manual guide to work with, and then having a mentor just to guide into that process will be a lot easier in the process to help with attrition. And just asking the new hire, what is it that you'd like to achieve professionally? Let's work towards that. I'll keep in mind of whatever particular interests you have that I can send your way, you know, signing up for like listservs like SecuSL, XECUSSL, SLSS at the end and then hyphen L has been pivotal for me when I first started in the field, just to see all the different ways people can pivot within study abroad itself and international education. So just there's a lot of free stuff out there, but it's just the attention out of making sure your hires have access to these things and know before you hire them what they can anticipate and that's actually going to be there for them on the other side.
I think what you said about the invisible added labor for folks in our field with a diverse or intersection social identity is really important. And it's one that's been on my mind a lot lately. So thank you for sharing your perspective there. I know our listeners would agree that having clear metrics as we approach our work in any position is helpful. What are some thoughts you have related to equitable practices for training folks and tracking success?
For this question regarding equitable practices for training individuals, would be touching on what I mentioned previously about having a standard policy and procedure. So one example would be a training manual so that everybody has access to that. Obviously, there might be some nuances with certain roles. You know, if you use a database to help track your student applicants for study abroad programs and things like that, it's pretty easy to like have your own internal manual that shows like screenshots of common actions you do within the system to collate data, update things, process applications, and so forth. So that could be something that everyone has. So that's equitable. And then in terms of how people can elevate questions, they could elevate to their supervisor, or maybe the supervisor has a mentor within the office who's well experienced utilizing the different software that you all have to manage applications and so forth, other administrative related policies, how to get things paid to overseas providers and what have you, putting on study abroad fairs, like what steps for each of those different projects, what do the steps entail for that? Roughly how much time do you anticipate each of those to take? To whom would the new hire need to contact to ensure X, Y, and Z is done? Like having those things written down is super helpful. And then having a mentor or their supervisor be available to address any questions that come up in that process as they're trying to better understand how all of those things intertwine with one another would be super helpful. But ensuring like whoever is going to mentor them also has that emotional intelligence to know how to assist them with when they hit snags and things like that. And then in terms of the other part of the question of tracking success, I would say there's always some form of a performance review. So usually within the first month or so that an individual starts a new job, they sit with their manager and they'll agree upon, these are the things that I, your manager, would like to have you hit within this review period. Do you agree? Is there anything you need us to tweak that's tweakable? You know, the stuff that you have to get done that's related to your role. But if there's anything else you'd like to add or tweak that also will align with your professional development during this review period, let me know. You all agree upon that. And then that's set for you to then refer back to at the end of your review period to see if you've hit or if you've hit that metric at minimum or underperformed or you've excelled at the metrics that were set. One other thing that just popped up regarding equitable practices for training, you know, I always like to use the term about the curse of competence, like for supervisors, a gentle reminder of, yes, there are employees who do a phenomenal work, but be mindful of adding on additional things because someone is really good at it. Make sure you also ask the person, is this a type of additional work you like to do, or would you like to focus elsewhere? In the pandemic, when there were a lot of vacancies and trying to have the whole staff handle roles that were vacant and splitting up duties, just something to be mindful of, because then that can also add an additional, I mean, everyone's going to have their additional burden somehow, but you want to make sure the added burden, if you're splitting up vacant roles because maybe you can't hire at this time. There's a hiring freeze. Just be mindful of that added burden so you don't potentially run the risk of losing employees as a result due to burnout or what have you. So that the curse of competence is real. You do something really well, like, wait, we'll give you more work. But just be mindful of how you do that. And, you know, the impact of what you do may come from what you didn't intend, how people receive that. So just be mindful of that.
If you're good at your job, you tend to be rewarded with more of it. And I know you, my friend, to be one who's intentional about using time well. I think you mentioned this earlier, and you know, earlier in my career, I was usually the person to always say yes to projects and put me on this committee and do this. And you know, I found myself to be overstretched during my 20s. So I've learned the power of no. I guess I should say I'm still learning the power of no because I still have some work to do myself. What are some tips you have to share with our listeners about managing time well?
The tips I would share would be for those who might be like me, as I like to call myself, a recovering perfectionist. You know, at this stage in my life, it's a matter of, it doesn't have to be perfect. It just needs to be done. But also, you know, being mindful of, you know what's on your plate at this current time. And if there's additional requests to add to that, that might go beyond the capacity you have and or sometimes the scope of your duties at times, I would recommend having a conversation with your supervisor. Just ensure I'm happy to take on additional work if you take something else off so that nothing falls off and doesn't get completed in the timeline set for that. And so, you know, it's important just to be mindful of that. Another tip I would give is something I learned from a colleague at a past institution in project management and said, they usually ask like a certain set of questions, like, do I love it? And am I good at this particular task or thing I'm considering to take on or I'm currently managing? And then the other question is, if not, if you don't love it, you're not good at it, can it be eliminated? Can it be automated or delegated? So I'm a huge advocate of what things can we automate when possible, if maybe we don't have enough staff support to take on the extra things in the field. We do a lot. We do so much in the field of study abroad, international education at large. And so just trying to better manage our workloads so that we can be functioning human beings in and outside of work is important. So if there's any ways that we can automate certain procedures, like pulling data of students for like study abroad programs before they need to partner a faculty-led study abroad program, I'm sure there's a way where we can figure out how to do that on Excel or like collating it from the database system where we have all of our applications within. And so just to make things easier. So it's always good to ask those questions like, I'm happy to get this done, but is there a way we can use the system better for our benefit? I'm a big advocate of streamlining processes and procedures, especially when there's kinks that need to be taken out. It's important to keep those things in mind. And so, yeah, being self-aware of what you are able to handle and if new things are being put on your plate, have a conversation with your supervisor. I could take on more and I can handle all of these things. But if you want me to add to that, it's going to put a strain. And so what can I not focus on at this time or someone else can handle if need be so that I can take care of all of these things, including the new one, without issue.
I think that our generation can learn from some of our younger colleagues, Gen Z, about the power of saying no when you can. Recent years have brought an influx of newcomers into international education who have advanced through the ranks of education abroad, taking on progressive responsibilities to reach the leadership level. Diversity is a must at every level of an organization, and getting there can often require buy-in and commitment from key stakeholders at every level. What are your thoughts on how we as a field, or perhaps higher education at large, can take steps to ensure that there is representation throughout an organization?
You know, looking at the organization chart at an organization to see when you start at those hierarchically in their roles who are at the bottom of that org structure at that office or business. And as you go from the bottom up to the top and looking at the diverse backgrounds of those from the organization, basically doing an assessment to see, okay, yes, we want to have diverse employees, but are we also creating those pipelines and opportunities of professional development where they take on extra work to allow them to ascend to get those leadership roles as well? Typically, most institutions, most businesses, most companies in all industries, unfortunately, that diversity starts to wane off typically as you get further towards the top of whether it's the CEO or it's those in the C-suite level or those, you know, in the field of international education, you know, SIOs, there aren't very many of diverse individuals in those top roles. So first you have to assess, like actually look and see what's going on, because you can't address a problem if you don't name it first. Secondly, then once you realize where you fall, in order to mitigate that, tying back into what we covered earlier about hiring and retention, addressing attrition, asking the people who are hired in the interviews and when they come on board, what is it that you want to achieve professionally? Where would you like to aspire to be? Is it a lateral transfer? Is it an upward transfer? What do you want to do and how can I help you get to that? How can I empower you to achieve those goals so that I can, you know, the term I've heard used outside of the field is like sponsorship, where someone is advocating on your behalf, maybe in rooms that you're not in, to help you achieve that professional accomplishment you would like to get towards, whether it's a role, a title change, additional responsibilities with that country, plus additional salary to boot, not just the title change and no extra money, because that's another topic for another day. All those things are important to keep in mind of what is it that we're doing? How is our actual makeup look in our board structure? Because just like the students, they want to see people in certain positions to show that it's possible to be achieved. Same thing professionally. Those who are doing their research about a company they're interviewing for, if they go look on LinkedIn and see, or on your website, that most of the people who are in leadership roles, whether it be assistant director, associate director, or manager, and so forth, are not people at least presenting, because people aren't going to have all their social identities on the website. But if presenting what you can see in the photos of them and their names or what have you, are, don't appear to be people of diverse backgrounds, that can be discouraging. It's tough being the only or being one of the few and having to pioneer and break glass ceilings. That can be a painful process. So when you assess all these things and you find out that maybe you don't have as diverse folks in leadership, then you need to be intentional. Okay, well, we need to be more intentional about that. Why is that? Let's ask our employees who are of diverse backgrounds. What is it that you like? Let's reassess. Have we been helping you achieve those goals? Did we even have a conversation about what your goals are? Okay, well, let's fix that. What can we do to help you get there with the resources that we have available? So when a role does open up, or sometimes roles are created in some rare instances within institutions, they will have what they need to then be able to assume those positions when the time is right. But that's first top of mind. They need to look and see how their makeup of their organization is on a, from the leadership standpoint. Those with actual titles. You can say people, quote unquote, hierarchically at the bottom are leaders, which is true, but there are those who are leaders in title and pay. So there's a distinction. You don't want to have that burnout and the invisible labor that we talked about earlier come into play.
Aganna, I know you're a part of the NAFSA Rise Fellows for 2020 to 2021. Could you tell us a bit about that program, its goals, and how it impacted both you and your cohort of fellows?
I really appreciated the Rise Fellowship because it allowed me the opportunity to have I think they called him a coach because it's been a while since I was in that program, but you have a coach from the NAFSA Academy. So your first year, you're in NAFSA Academy, the second year of it is when you start working towards your goals that you have set. You can also work on your goals that are set with the NAFSA coach in the NAFSA Academy for your region during that first year, but you really start to put things to paper and like put action behind it. And so the timing of it wasn't ideal because it was right at the start of the pandemic, but I appreciated that we were all able to meet in person one time, which was at the NAFSA Academy. I think it was early March, like a suit of 2020 when really things started to spread outside of East Asia. And having that community where people of different diverse backgrounds, you know, some as like an SIO and others in different subsects of the field, it was great to be able to talk shop, bounce ideas, also be a safe space to share frustrations and how we could not just gripe about things, but honestly, how we could support each other, elevate one another. We co-presented, gosh, I think out of our cohort of 11 or so people for the virtual NAFSA National Conference that happened in 2021. Many of us co-presented together on this topic that we've been covering today on the podcast regarding like supporting diverse professionals. There were other sessions, other STIT as well. It was a great synergy and opportunity for us to see how we could improve ourselves to meet our professional goals, have the slated time for that away from like our usual duties. And it just allowed for a lot of professional growth through the NAFSA Academy and having, you know, all of our coaches were amazing that we each individually had based upon our region. It was great. I would have preferred to be able to go to my first, as I called my big NAFSA conference in person, but I understand because of the pandemic, it had to be virtual. But I'm looking forward to presenting in person and attending in person for the first time this coming May. But I am always a huge advocate of the program because this is the intentionality that I was talking about. In terms of offices that are cash strapped, it does help subsidize a lot of these expenses, like NAFSA Academy is covered. Things may have changed in terms of what is included with the fellowship. They may have had to shrink it down a little bit, but I know it helps cover your NAFSA Academy for the 1 year, and it covers the NAFSA National Conference attendance. In my cohort at the time, it covered your travel, per diem, hotel, which is a huge expense. That's thousands of dollars combined between just those two things, a conference and the NAFSA Academy. So it was a godsend. I still am connected with some of the folks from my cohort today, and they continue to go on and do amazing things. So anyone else that is interested in the NAFSA Rise program, every year they have their applications come out. You can like search for that on the NAFSA website. And I think their applications are usually due like sometime in the fall. And then they let you know in January or so if you've been selected or not. It's a great opportunity. Your supervisor just has to say that they are on board with you, devoting some of your working hours towards that. So free professional development.
What other advice would you give that we haven't yet covered on the important topic of diversifying the international education workforce?
Like those who want to be applicants or applying for these roles and there are diverse backgrounds, there may be times where you have been discouraged or you feel like you're not good enough for certain roles. But if you look at what you've done and in the past and past roles and accomplishments that you've achieved, I always say, which is a side note of it's important to keep kind of tying back into like success metrics and tracking your success with your supervisor. I have like a kudos sheet. There's so many things that we do in the field. I can't keep everything straight off the top of my head. As I get older, it's harder for me to remember things, honestly. And so I have to write them down. I have like a Google Doc or something and I just type, oh, this is what I accomplished this week, or this was something I got a commendation for because I did that really well. Because there's so many little things that you just forget. So, you know, anytime that you might feel discouraged or you feel like, oh, I'm staying at this same level and I haven't progressed forward or what have you, or if for some reason that the environment that you're working in and folks may say that you haven't been able to do X, Y, and Z, you have your own track sheet that you can refer to and you have the evidence to provide that. But just for those who are doing the work and you're doing great work, it's always important to keep a track of your kudos, what you accomplished, and make sure you have that in your resume, your LinkedIn profile, so that anytime you've presented at a conference, list that also. Those are all really great things to have. How you improved things at your workplace for the benefit of all, not just yourself. It's just important to make sure you're your own advocate. Sometimes that can be hard and maybe some people may not know how to do that. That's one step in that. And be confident in letting folks know, not arrogant because there's a difference, but letting folks know these are all the great things that I did, not just for my benefit, but for the team. Because sometimes people forget too. So someone has many direct reports. It might be difficult to remember every single thing that someone has done that was amazing. So it's important to articulate that. I know for me, when I first started in the field, I was more like the way I was raised is in my Nigerian American household, we'd be more humble. But sometimes, you know, in a U.S. working place, that might be to our detriment. And so, again, not to be arrogant, but you could say, yeah, I'm so excited that I did X, Y, and Z, and this is the impact of the work that I did, and you have the number metrics, or I increased the number, I nearly doubled the number of faculty-led programs that will be offered at my current institution, and that will build this much revenue for us or what have you. And of course, more importantly, like the impact of the students and having their lives transformed. More students can access these programs to have transformation in their academic, professional, maybe even future research lives, what have you. So just make sure not to sell yourself short. that would be my advice for those who are looking to apply for roles or progress up the upward trajectory ladder
at their current institutions.
I think what you said about keeping a list of your wins is hugely important. And my advice to listeners, find a system that works for you. For me, it's the Notes app in my phone, because if I don't write it down, I will absolutely forget it. And everyone has a different way of organizing themselves, and that's just mine. I just have a few more questions for you, my friend, as we begin to wrap up here. If you, Ogana, had three wishes related to our conversation today and to our field, what would they be?
One would be for professionals of all backgrounds, but particularly with those of diverse backgrounds, just to have that belief in yourself. The right thing will come for you at the right time. Keep doing what you need to do. So just to have that conference is one wish for them. I'd say for organizations within the field, it's always good to take an assessment of how things are in terms of your recruitment and retention and what could be improved. And maybe even having like exit surveys for people that leave so that you have data to track. And so that can help you try and handle that issue. And then thirdly, I'd say within the entire field, kind of what we talked about before, being open to new ways of doing things, seeing how others outside of our field accomplish what we do and having it be translatable and actionable within our field, like those automations I referenced earlier, I think would be really helpful, as many folks in the field are still trying to have enough roles, but they don't have enough funding to hire at times, or there's hiring freezes or what have you. And so just finding new creative ways, like having consultants from other industries come in to assess that and give them advice on what they can do, I think would be really helpful so that we can continue to be strong in this field as more things come our way. And there's so much important work that's involved in this field, but for it to continue to be sustainable, I think we need some other ways of seeing how we can handle some of these ongoing pervasive issues in the field, at least when it relates to retention and support for professionals and having diverse individuals, diverse thoughts and ways of doing things being added into the mix.
For my final question, I have this one for you, my friend. As you contemplate education abroad in 2024, what makes you hopeful?
What makes me hopeful is the opportunities that are upon the horizon. As we, you know, mentioned before, there's new generations of folks coming into the field. I'm happy to see that they are more vocal and they advocate more for the things they will put up with and things they will not. And I say that not as as an affront per se, but they can put action behind things like, oh, we don't have to just keep doing the same things over and over again. And so I'm happy to see that with some individuals that I've encountered in the field, they're realizing these things sooner so that they figure out, hey, what can we do to fix this? We can't just keep doing the same thing. So that makes me hopeful that these new opportunities, part of my wish for what I'd like to see happen in the field. I'm looking forward to the new ways these newcomers will be helping us all to achieve that in 2024 and beyond.
Ogana Owu-Jones, what a brilliant and inspiring conversation. Our field is a better one because you're a part of it. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Zach. I really appreciate the time.
And to our listeners, thank you so much for joining us for this episode of Changing Lives Through Education Abroad. I am your host, Zach McGinnis, and please make sure to join us next week as we continue to explore topics around international education and exchange. Thank you to my spectacular World Strides colleagues, Lindsay Kelchner and Sarah Kachuba, without whom this podcast would not be possible. Please subscribe to Changing Lives Through Education Abroad on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And share with your friends and colleagues. Let's create life-changing moments together.